So next we have Linda Maison. Linda is the chair of the Canadian Accounting Standards Setup, so she's going to give her comments.
Okay, can you hear me?
We have to help each other.
So, one of my comments in introducing myself, yes, I'm the chair of the Accounting Standards Board, but I'm a standard setter, but I'm not a standard setter like she is, because she speaks your language in terms of the academic world, and I do not. So my background, just to be clear, is, I don't know if it's schizophrenic, but I'm originally from the U.S., but I've been in Canada since 1987. So I'm bilingual. I speak American and Canadian. One could argue that they're not the same. But before I became a standard setter, I was one of the dreaded management prepare types. You know, the ones who everybody thinks manipulates earnings on a regular basis. So I have a dual background. And it is very much from that experience base that I'm going to comment. And happily, when Anne asked me to do this, she said, you don't need to worry about the design of the research study or whatever. That's good, because I couldn't do that anyway. So I'm going to give you very much my take on the document, the way I read it through my eyes. And I think that's actually really important, because as a standard setter, so I've been the chair of the Accounting Standards Board for 6 years now, but prior to that, I was a volunteer member of the Accounting Standards Board in Canada, because that's our model. We have a paid position as the chair, but the rest of the members are appointed as volunteers. So I've actually been a standard setter for about 15 years now. And over the course of that time, I've become to believe that academics are really kind of a key source of information for us, because you have such an independent mindset, and you get us to look at things in a much more holistic way than perhaps, because of our biases towards, we think that this is the outcome we're after. But you can kind of pull us back a little and get us to look at this in a much more objective and big picture way. In fact, our board feels so strongly about it that we've dedicated a position now in terms of research. Rebecca's here. Wave at everybody, Rebecca. So she's doing, Director of Research and Reporting Initiatives, right? So she very much focuses on this, and we think this is very important. So without further ado, this slide basically says, here's what I got from reading the paper. So what I got was that it was considered, the author was saying this was a robust approach, and he extended his sample. And from everything I've heard so far, I got that right. And then I got the assertion that firms are more likely to adopt when they already had intangibles under Japanese GAAP. And I think that that's also what we're saying. And that ultimately this results in capitalizing more intangibles, et cetera. And so my one comment here would be, in my simple mind, and by the way, when you said orthogonal, I had to use Google to look that up, but I got the gist of it. That's how good I am in statistics. But anyway, orthogonal, I think. The one thing I would say about this is there is a bit of circularity, I think, to the reasoning, from the standpoint that, you know, coming as a manager, if I'm in a company and I'm contemplating my business model, which is I've already got some intangibles on my balance sheet, and I'm thinking about adopting IFRS, maybe. By the way, that's not a small decision. I went through an IFRS adoption when I was still in the banking industry. So it's not a small decision to contemplate a change in GAAP. So am I going to do that so I can capitalize more? Or am I going to do that because I think my business model is going to get supported in some way or shape or form by adopting IFRS? And usually, and in Canada, when we decided to move to IFRS, we did so on the basis that we thought that the capital markets activity within our Canadian companies would be improved if we were on a set of standards that were more comparable to other jurisdictions around the world. So I kind of questioned that a company would decide to go to IFRS so they can capitalize more. Rather, I think that they were a growing company, they might be have global operations, they might have already been acquisitive in nature, and so they felt that that framework was going to enable them to move forward. So I would at least think about that in terms of your studying going forward. Next, I was very interested in the notion of the real effects, the way the document talked about the real effects. Now, like it or not, the way I read this was that the real effect was on the way management may have affected their decision-making as a result of this adoption. So in other words, management says, okay, here's an opportunity for me to adopt these new set of standards, and it's going to let me capitalize more. Okay, that's kind of what I read. So when you're talking about the real effects, then perhaps you might want to make that clearer, because I don't think, as a prior manager, that I would have thought that way. Now, I'll acknowledge that this. There is this notion of short-termism versus a long-term effect, which I thought was very interesting in your paper. So management could think short-term and say, whoa, if I go to these new sets of standards and I can capitalize more, that takes some pressure off my P&L and I report better results in the short term. But guess what happens? You got to amortize some of this stuff. No, you don't have to amortize goodwill under IFRS yet. Okay, whatever. See, I'm old enough that I remember when everybody was amortizing goodwill, so there you go. But management also knows that that's kind of a transitory effect. They know that if they start plowing stuff on their balance sheet, odds are, sooner or later, they're going to have to deal with it. So I think that's kind of a short-termism. And so when you're talking about the real impact, perhaps it would be helpful if you could describe that more, because I'm not sure, at the end of the day, that is, in and of itself, would ask a company to go to IFRS because it's such an endeavor. And so what I would... And it goes very much in line with the previous speaker saying, look a little deeper into the companies. Look a little deeper into the circumstances, you know, behind your companies in terms of, you know, who they were, what they were doing before that, to help explain whether this is actually kind of the predominant factor that you want to focus on. Because I think that would actually add a lot of usefulness. Speaking now as a standards setter, that would add a lot of usefulness in terms of the results of your study for us to take into consideration, which is what I want to talk about. I hope I'm right. Yes. This is a really important topic. So let me just build on that. What you're focused on right now is really two kinds of intangibles. And goodwill, obviously, right? But the notion is that the topic of intangibles is actually way bigger than this. So you say in the paper early on about how the balance sheets don't reflect like 80% of the assets. Totally agree. But we don't touch that here. So I'm wondering, and again, I'm not an academic, but I'm wondering if that's something for you to build on in the future. Because, for instance, and Rebecca knows this because she's been working very hard on it, but we're working with a group of other standard setters to do some research on intangible and on tangibles and what might come down the path in terms of future standard setting activities at both the ISB and the FASB level, because we actually do talk to both, okay? And a novel concept, but we do. There are so many value drivers in today's economy that are never making their way to the balance sheet. And, you know, we think, this group of folks, thinks that we should be looking at that, because when you look at our economies now, so it's so dominated by the Google, the Amazon, the whole thing, where a big chunk of the value proposition that they bring never gets on the balance sheet. And let's face it, the other thing you have to consider in this paper is the stuff is getting on the balance sheet only through acquisitions. You're not putting internally generated goodwill on the balance sheet. We've long lived with the notion that if you do an acquisition, you get to put stuff on the balance sheet, like brands or workforce or whatever, that you don't put on the balance sheet just through your own operations. And so I think the impetus for this paper, going to the next step, would be to look at that, the more far-flung opportunity of the notion that you just aren't reflecting the value of these entities on the balance sheet in either Japanese GAAP or IFRS today. Okay, I think for me it goes way beyond whether or not amortization is a factor in terms of the growing balances in goodwill, which is true, but I think it's much more. And so when you think about this, it's very much around the notion of enhancing the relevance of the balance sheet to the users of financial information, because what do they care about? They care about future cash flows, et cetera. So what they're trying to figure out is where those future cash flows are going to come from. And they're already doing something today offline to figure out what is the value of this, what is the value of that. But as standard setters, can we help them by doing that, always keeping the cost-benefit assessment in mind? Because we don't want to write standards that are so complex that nobody can implement them well. And that's one of the things that this area is plagued by. It's a complex impairment test that you have to do. Nobody really understands it. And that's why we have difficulties. The other thing I would suggest would be, can you extend this example very much in keeping with the previous speaker? I think the research is useful, but you've got to get it beyond one jurisdiction perspective. Okay, so can you generalize it? So there's 140 some jurisdictions applying IFRS. Canada is one of them. But the point is, as we make a contribution to standard setting, most relevant if we could just make sure we can generalize it beyond one jurisdiction. And so I would ask you to consider that. I think, Rebecca, you told me that Switzerland is also voluntary. So can you generalize it? If you're going to hone in on the notion of voluntary adoption, can you hone in on at least on other jurisdictions that might be doing voluntary adoption, something like that? And then the other comment is, you know, when you write a paper like this, it would be helpful if you could kind of point us in the right direction to your meaning. Meaning, we all in our own professions have jargon, okay? And so I have jargon, and you have jargon. I mean, I'm getting older now, and I've been having some medical tests recently. Nobody uses jargon more than medical doctors. It's like I stare at them and say, is that good or bad? Like, could you tell me that in plain English? So we all do it. But like the notion, like, I read this 17 times, this the part on this tap, and I figured I either got to go read that other paper, or I got to wait for you to tell me what you were talking about. Now, I sort of got it, right? But I would just say if you could elaborate on why this is relevant. Like, I always tell my staff, don't forget the so what. What's the so what in plain English for all of us to understand? Because as a poor standard setter, if I'm going to be able to work with academics, I kind of need to know what you're trying to tell me. And by the way, your students kind of need to know how to say things in plain English, even no matter what they do, you know, in terms of their future profession. And with that, I always include my contact information, happy to answer any questions. But I really appreciate the opportunity to meet you all today and to be here. And Anne, thank you so much for asking me. So thank you very much.